Well, can I welcome everybody on this occasion, the launch of our new Centre of Governance and Human Rights. It's been made possible by the generosity of David and Elaine Potter and the Potter Foundation, and we are extremely pleased that they're able to be here tonight for this launch and inaugural lecture. When we planned this centre and thought about the aims that it should have, we wanted it to be a centre for new thinking on governance and human rights and the challenges in the 21st century. There are, of course, many centres of human rights around the world, but we hope that this centre will bring a distinctive focus on the interrelationship of governance and human rights. And we're well aware that such a centre is only going to succeed if it is outward-looking and manages to establish links far beyond Cambridge with those involved in human rights issues around the world. The centre sits within the Department of Politics and International Studies, itself a new venture in Cambridge launched earlier this year. We want the new department to be the focus of the study of the political and the study of the international at Cambridge, something which has not existed quite in this way before. And our philosophy is to be open, engaged, and connecting with other disciplines and centres at Cambridge and beyond Cambridge. And the Centre of Governance and Human Rights is a microcosm of what we want the new department to be. Our speaker tonight is Francis Deng, and we are pleased and honoured to have him here and to welcome him to Cambridge. He is a true scholar practitioner and a highly distinguished one. He has done pioneering work on human rights, on governance, and conflict resolution in Africa. And in his academic work has combined the study of human rights with governance and law, with politics and international relations. He was an early and ardent champion of the idea of sovereignty as responsibility as it relates to preventing grave humanitarian crises. In his career, he started as a human rights advisor to the United Nations, and more recently he has been special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the prevention of genocide. He has also been ambassador for the Sudan, to the Nordic countries, and Sudan's State Minister for Foreign Affairs. He holds law degrees from Khartoum and Yale, and he has had appointments at Yale, at NYU, at City University of New York, at MIT, at Johns Hopkins, and he's been a research fellow at the Brookings Institute and the US Institute for Peace, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies. It's quite a list. He's also authored and edited more than 30 books, and he's also written, which intrigues me, two novels, which look at the theme of the crisis of national identity in the Sudan. He's particularly known for his work on the causes and consequences of conflict in Africa. And he's been the United Nations Secretary General's special representative on internally displaced persons between 1992 and 2004, and he wrote the landmark Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement. He has looked at the issues of human rights, of local governance, of national sovereignty, of state responsibility and international community. And it is with great pleasure that I ask him to give the lecture tonight. His theme is the United Nations and the Prevention of Genocide. Francis Deng.
sure you will agree with me that it is very difficult to speak after such a lavish introduction. And perhaps I can claim that we did not consult before as to what should go into the introduction. Otherwise, I would have done some editing. I really would like to express my profound appreciation for being invited. I'm very honored. And the occasion is, of course, a very significant one, not only because of the importance of the Center of Governance and Human Rights, but because of what I know to be the intention to relate it to Africa. And I have to say that although we encourage African institutions to develop their capacity to deal with African problems, we also realize that linkages with the outside world is critical to Africa addressing African problems. And I've often said that when we speak of globalization, it can only be significant if we also see it in the context of localization, and that one has to link the local with the global. So I'd like to add my voice of profound appreciation to the Potters for making this possible and for your being here tonight. I can't resist recalling, with the reference to being distinguished, recalling an incident where a number of us who had been in various positions of government went to see the Secretary General of the OAU at the time. And after a good meeting with him, he took us to his senior staff and said to them, as they gathered there, "Let me introduce you to our extinguished leaders." And the interesting thing is, he did not mean to say a joke. It was a slip, which made it even more significant. But I would like to also begin with another anecdote and apologize to those of you here who might be ambassadors or diplomats. It has to do with when I was in Scandinavia as ambassador, and I was invited to give a lecture at the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation, and the invitations went out referring to me as Dr. Deng, not Ambassador Deng. And when I got there, the president was somewhat apologetic. He said, "I hope you don't mind our referring to you as Dr. Deng instead of Ambassador Deng." And I said, "Of course not. I just understood that, or I assume that you give more credence to academic credentials than to diplomatic niceties." And he said, "Actually, the real reason is Swedes think ambassadors are boring." And the attendance might not have been the same had we introduced him. And I began to wonder why, if they did, why they thought ambassadors boring. And the only reason I could think of is ambassadors are assumed to be so diplomatic. They never say anything controversial and therefore exciting. It's a blend. So whenever I give a talk and I recall this anecdote, I try to tell myself not to be too diplomatic. And that leads me to my second anecdote, which I think is even more pertinent to the topic of my talk, management of diversity as a means of preventing genocide. In 1969, and I was then at the United Nations, and I had one of my brothers who was a medical doctor practicing here in England, and we flew back to our dying father in the midst of a civil war. Security forces were everywhere, people were being arrested, tortured, killed. And amidst all that commotion, our father being the chief of the tribe who died in Cairo, and we flew back and then back to the village, to his headquarters. Amidst all that commotion, the people despairing that the man who was their protector was suddenly gone, an old man who was the oldest great uncle, in fact, called the Mahdi because he was born when the Mahdi appeared in the Sudan, and that is going into the 80s, 1885. He asked to talk to us, and we sat apart, surrounded by the military and security forces. And then he asked whether we were in touch with the British who had been in the Sudan. And we told him we were in touch with some of them. He really got quite excited and wanted to be assured, really? He said, yes, really. He said, when they came to leave, they came here to our tribe and called a large gathering of the tribe. And they said to us, we are leaving your country, but we'll keep a close watch on developments in your country. If you Sudanese fail to get along, we will be back. Could you please go and tell them we have failed to get along? Now, that is a sad commentary on independence, of course, but it also shows the extent to which, even after independence, people kept looking to the outside world for protection, mediation, helping with the building of peace. And of course, former colonial officers are usually seen as the closest to assuming that responsibility. In thinking about this theme, I thought I would address myself to three areas of my work which have already been referred to, and that is establishing the Brookings Project, Africa Project, which I did in the late 80s, and then my experience with the work on internal displacement as the special representative of the Secretary General, and then my current position as special advisor for the prevention of genocide. After leaving the government, I was invited, after various positions, number of positions, by the Brookings Institution to establish their Africa Project. And the framework I wanted to build for establishing the project, and this was in the late 1980s, was to ask two questions. One, what are the critical policy areas that call for serious research that can advise policy and be a basis for action, looking at the continent of Africa? And secondly, how would the impending end of the Cold War impact on our perceptions of these problems and how they should be addressed? Coming from the Sudan as I did, it did not take long to come to the conclusion that the priority areas should be conflict, prevention, management, and resolution, democratic participation, issues of democracy, human rights protection, and equitable socioeconomic development. And considering my academic interests, or should I say research interests, culture was a very important cross-cutting theme. And having started my work in studying customary law and on into various aspects of culture and oral history and some of the themes that might have been already alluded to in the introduction, I consider the cross-cultural perspectives on all of these topics critically important. Some people may see conflict resolution as a science that is universal. Some may look at democracy in the same vein, same with human rights, and of course, development. But having lived across cultures, and having, in a sense, been a beneficiary of cross-cultural perspectives, I find the cultural dimension in each of these areas very important. Now, as we began to do our work, we solicited studies, commissioned studies, conducted studies from within the institution ourselves, and produced books in a number of these themes relating to conflict resolution, human rights, democracy, development. But my work then began to focus on conflict management. And asking the question how the end of the Cold War would impact on conflict prevention, management, and resolution. One recalled the times during the Cold War when we would see these conflicts, whether they were internal or regional, as proxy wars of superpowers. And therefore, there was a tendency to not really get deep to the root causes of these problems, but simply analyze them in ideological terms and addressing them in terms of the superpower rivalries, alliances, and that sort of thing. So the end of the Cold War was clearly going to mean this element would be removed, which would mean that we would see conflicts in their proper context as regional or internal. And as such, it would be a positive step because we would have a better understanding of the root causes of these problems. But also it would mean reapportioning responsibility in a state of dependency on the superpowers. We, meaning the states concerned, the regions concerned, would have to take the primary responsibility in dealing with their problems. But given the context of the post-Cold War concern with human rights and humanitarian issues, no state could say, I'm assuming my responsibilities domestically, and whether I perform well or not, it's none of the business of the international community. Sovereignty protects me. That is why we began to develop the notion that yes, governance means assuming responsibilities for your domestic situations. But yes, you cannot barricade yourself against the world if conditions within the state threaten protection of human rights and create humanitarian situations that the world calls for. And so after a series of studies that were country-specific or regional and producing a series of volumes, we came to the conclusion of seeing governance as conflict management and as a form of responsibility, and titled the volume that has since become better known than others, Sovereignty as Responsibility. What sovereignty as responsibility entails is three tiers. The first tier is the responsibility of the state to protect and assist its own people who are in need. The second, if the state lacks the capacity and needs support from the international community, then it can call on the world to come and assist. And that way, it would enhance its own legitimacy at home and internationally, and also get the support for its own people. But should the state not have the capacity and then lacks the will to call on the international community to come and help, and people are suffering and dying, the world is not going to watch, sit, and do nothing. And therefore, the advice to the states is you can best protect your sovereignty by discharging the responsibilities of sovereignty and being seen to discharge the responsibilities of sovereignty. Otherwise, the international community will find one way or another of getting involved to fill the vacuum of responsibility. Now, identity-related conflicts are very rampant in Africa. We do have a tendency, frankly, to shy away from discussing issues of race or ethnicity and even religion. And we hear it said quite often that real ethnicity is just being exploited by political entrepreneurs. Or even religion is just a tool for politicians to exploit. Race is, of course, something we shy away from talking about. And it is true that some of these are elusive concepts that you cannot really get a hold of. But I think by denying that these concepts do not exist and that they are the imaginations of some entrepreneuring politicians, we fail to deal with the issues of diversity in a constructive way. We don't need to go through how African countries were carved out in a manner that broke groups and brought groups together and created a sense of unity and diversity in which the nation state or the new state embodied diverse ethnic, religious, racial groups, but were kept apart. And during the period of the colonial struggle, independence struggle was a unifying factor, so that despite the differences, there was a collective struggle. What is more important is it wasn't just simply differences, because disparities were injected into those differences. Certain regions were given opportunities to develop, others were neglected. And yet, despite the disparities, despite the gross inequalities, there was assumed to a degree a common purpose in fighting for independence. Even though there, we have to say, not everybody was enthusiastic about independence, because there were groups that felt themselves clearly disadvantaged, and so that the prospects for the future for them after independence may not be all that great. I think it's important to point out that it is not the mere differences, whether we're talking ethnicity, race, religion, what have you, that creates conflicts. Just because we are different does not make us in conflict. It is the implications of those differences, usually in terms of sharing of power, wealth, respect for rights, rights of citizenship. In my travels around the world, and this is something I'll come back to later, countries that are torn apart by conflicts, generating internal displacement, that is my next area of concern, you always found there's a group, an in-group, that enjoys all the rights of citizenship on more or less equal footing, and a group that is marginalized, discriminated, excluded, some of them seeing their rights rights of citizenship only of paper value rather than a full realization of those rights. Now, at independence, all these differences that had been suppressed and the disparities began to come to the fore. Those who had been given the opportunity for development, education, economic opportunities, assumed, in a sense, the role of the new masters. And some regions that were clearly neglected became victims of what some would have called internal colonialism. And so the competition for power, resources, and all that began to take place. What is compounding the problem is that the constitutions that African countries inherited from colonialism were models that had actually not developed from within. These were mostly European models, which assumed a degree of homogeneity, models that even during the colonial period had not been applied with their ideals, because colonial domination was clearly not one that applied the ideals of democracy, human rights, of the types that the West had enjoyed. And so not only were the models of foreign origin, they did not address the pressing concerns of these countries, particularly in terms of how you manage diversity and how you apply the cultural values to give these notions of governance grounding in the local cultures. And then ironically, because diversity was seen as a threat to unity, concepts were developed such as the one-party system, so-called African socialism, and ideas that literally meant let us defer human rights because the pressing problems of independent countries were how to develop quickly, how to fight our real enemies, ignorance, poverty, issues of human rights and democracy were seen as luxuries. It is true that ideas of traditional values were used, sometimes with a degree of sophistication. People like Nyerere, for instance, would talk about the one-party system, or Ujamaa as an African, as rooted in the African culture. You would have human concepts of humanism, which was developed by the Zambian president, or people like conscientism by Nkrumah. Just about every African leader of that generation came up with some traditional way of legitimizing what were in essence external ideological concepts. And so you could say there might have been an instinct that we should make these concepts relevant to our culture. But whether it had to do with deliberate calculation to legitimize something that was known not to be indigenous, or whether it was for lack of understanding of the cultural values, the fact of the matter is that there was a gap between the new concepts that are now being applied by the Africans, most of which were of foreign origin, and the claim that they were rooted in the traditional culture. And so you had a degree of instability resulting from these internal conflicts. Some of these conflicts were claims by disadvantaged groups to assert themselves and demand equality. Some of these were liberalization towards a more liberal society from what it had been, irrespective of the diversities of the ethnic or racial or religious groups. I think it's important also to go back to what social scientists tell us, that identity is not what you objectively are, it's what you subjectively think yourself to be. And so if I think I'm white, even though I'm black, people say, well, if you think you're white and you're black, that's your business. But if what you think you are has an impact on others and affects the rights and status of other people, then I think you should be questioned. What we have in many of these countries are self-perceptions that distort objective realities. And then these distorted self-perceptions are then imposed on the whole society, ignoring the pluralism of the society. I mean, the countries that come to mind very easily to me, my own country of the Sudan, where in a historical context in which if you became a Muslim, Arabic speaking, culturally Arabized, and you could trace your ancestry to Arabia, or imagine that you have an Arab ancestor, you were elevated into a status of respectability and dignity. If you are a black and a heathen, you are denigrated and a legitimate target for slavery. If you go to Darfur and you look at these people who are claiming Arabs and Africans, and you would have a hard time telling who's an Arab and who's an African. Now, I went to Burundi and I would address audiences in which some look typical Tutsi the way we are told Tutsis look, and some typical Hutu. With many in between, I couldn't tell. And so talking to some of the ministers later, particularly the Minister of Foreign Affairs, I asked, can you always tell a Tutsi from a Hutu? And the answer I got was, yes, but with a margin of error of 35%. You know, in Bosnia, in former Yugoslavia, I had the same. I couldn't tell who was an Arab, who was a Muslim, and who was a Serb. And people have this tremendous conviction that they are so different, when objectively, there's a lot in common. Sudanese from the north have taken pride in being Arabs. Sudanese from the south take pride in being African, blacks. And when you look at them, really someone who doesn't quite know, and some of you I'm sure have been to the Sudan and have seen the complexities of the so-called Arab and African. And this is where I think there is room for asking people to stand in front of the mirror and say, you are sharply divided by certain myths that are generating a lot of tension, conflict, violence, when there's a lot in common that history has made you not see and distort. And so there's an educational function in trying to address the issues of diversity. But ultimately, the challenge is how to address the questions of gross inequalities and denial of the rights of citizenship. During my travels dealing with IDP problems, and I went to some over 30 countries, you will always hear two themes to the history, to the memory of history. One is that we have always been in conflict with these people, you know, repeated. Another is we've always been at peace with them. We've always intermarried, shared our happy occasions, sad occasions. We don't know what has happened. And in a way, both are correct, because if groups live next to one another, it's inevitable that sooner or later they will come into conflict. But by the same token, they find conventional ways of managing their relations, their differences, and fostering peaceful coexistence. So when conflicts then erupt, negative memories come up. When people are at peace and cooperating, only good memories come up. I did a study on the Dink of the Sudan from the area called Abyei, which I'm sure some of you would have heard of because it's a contested area, nowadays described as the oil-rich area of Abyei, which has become the curse of the area. The first interview I did with a group of elders from the area was shortly after the Addis Ababa Agreement of 1972, when Abyei issue was neglected. Yes, there was a provision that the people of Abyei would be given the option to choose whether to remain in the north or join the south. And they have always been a border people. And they were very embittered by the fact that peace had come to the country and their situation remained very tense. In fact, they were still under oppression. The interview material I collected from that, from the questions related to the beginning of creation, to early migrations, contact with the outside world, on to where we now are, and a vision into the future. Where is the country headed? Will there be integration? Or will people remain separate? During the first interview, shortly after the end of the agreement, I mean, end of the war, when they had been neglected, they were very bitter. Their history of relations between the Arabs and the Dinka, from creation to visions of the future, where we are created different. And there's no way we can even integrate. God would be offended if we were to want to get together and be one people. Then we intervened and found some solutions that seem to appeal to the people, giving them their local autonomy, mini autonomy, development, brought some support from the outside, and people felt satisfied. So my second interview, posing the same questions, they would say, we're created one people by God. You know, there's no Dink or Arab, whatever, we're one people. And the future is one of integration. We're going to be mixing. Totally different story. And you see that all the time, that under circumstances of hostility and conflict, people don't want to see anything in common. And then, under conditions of peace, there's a tendency to build on that which is positive. And so, managing diversity in this context really means shifting in the context of, as I said, shifting away from seeing conflicts as proxy wars of others, to internalizing them, and to addressing what the root causes are, which is in dealing with issues of inequity and respect for human rights, and reapportioning responsibilities where the first line of responsibility must be domestic with support from the outside world. The mandate on internal displacement came to me as a total surprise. I got a phone call from Boutros Ghali saying, your name has come up to be my special representative on internal displaced persons. And I'm of course delighted to ask you. We knew one another. We had both been ministers of state for foreign affairs of our two countries. And so I said, I'm honored and pleased, but could you have your people give me more details on what this entails before I give you my final word? And that's when he said, come on, Francis, I know you well and I know how concerned you are with these issues. This is not only a global crisis, it's one that affects our continent of Africa the most. And in Africa, it is your country of the Sudan that is the worst hit. And in the Sudan, it is your people of Southern Sudan who are the main victims. I cannot see how you can say no. So I'll tell them you have accepted. And later on, if you insist, we can talk about it some more. And he was right. You know, what we call internal displacement affects some, at my time anyway, some 30 million people in over 50 countries, people who have been uprooted by conflicts, but who have not crossed international borders. Had they crossed international borders, they would be recognized as refugees, and there's a well-established international system, both normative and institutional, to deal with them. The 1951 Convention on Refugees and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. But those who remain within the borders of their countries, by virtue of being inside the country, are assumed to be the responsibilities of their countries. And they fall under the sovereignty of the state. Now, the irony is not only are they still within the country and therefore close to the areas of conflict, but very often they are at war with their own governments, or at least they are associated with people who are at war with their own governments. And so instead of being protected, there's a vacuum of responsibility in which they fall. What I would do as Representative Secretary General is talk to the leadership and then go down to the people who are affected, the displaced populations, then come back to report to the government authorities and on to the international community to plead the case of the displaced. What I would do is ask them, what message would you want me to take to your leaders? In one Latin American country, the response was, those are not our leaders. We have nobody in that government. To that government, we are criminals. And our only crime is that we are poor. In a Central Asian country, the answer was the same, except it was seen in terms of ethnic alienation. Nobody from our group is in that government. In an African country, a prime minister complained to a senior UN official that the country was overburdened by refugees and overtaxing the resources. And the UN official said, we have limited resources, but we are helping your internally displaced populations. The prime minister said, those are not my people. In fact, the food you give to those people is killing my soldiers. And so you see clearly the vacuum of responsibility into which these people fall. But then, when they look to the international community to fill the vacuum, sovereignty is used as a barricade against them. Now, when I assumed that position of representative on internally displaced persons, I had to ask myself, this issue by definition falls under the sovereignty of the state. And states are very protective of their sovereignty, particularly under these kinds of circumstances. What should I do? That's when I used the concept we had developed at Brookings as my strategy, sovereignty as responsibility. What this means, going to a country, the first 5 minutes with the president or a minister were crucial in saying, I realize this problem is internal by definition. It falls under your sovereignty. I respect your state sovereignty, but I don't see it negatively as a barricade against the world. I see it as a positive concept of responsibility of the state to protect its own people, and that your standing domestically and internationally depends to a large measure on your living up to that responsibility. If you cannot, call on the international community to assist you. But if you don't, and your people are suffering and dying, the world will find one way or another of getting involved. You're better off living up to your responsibility as the best way to protect your sovereignty. That became my message, and I think it was relatively successful. We developed guiding principles on internal displacement, which were premised on the responsibilities of sovereignty by the states themselves with the cooperation of the international community. Now, if I come to my present position, which again came in almost the same way as the first mandate, I got an email from someone who said the Secretary General was about to make a decision on appointing a successor to the first special advisor, and you are on the list, perhaps on top of the list, and he wants to know if he asked you, would you consider accepting? And my response was, this comes to me as a total surprise. I was not at all aware of. But if I were asked, I would take it as a call of duty and a service to humanity, which I cannot take lightly. They arranged for me to meet with the Secretary General 2 days later, and 4 days after meeting him, my appointment was announced. I now had to worry, what did I put myself into? What do I do with this huge, daunting task of genocide prevention? And we all know that genocide is such a heinous crime that the international community, humanity, must be united in preventing it and punishing it. But by the same token, because it is such an emotional, emotive issue, people tend to be in denial when it comes to genocide. All the cases of genocide we know are in retrospect. When the situation has radically changed, those responsible are gone. It's a judgment of the victor over the vanquished. But while it is happening or unfolding, both the perpetrators and those who would be called upon to step in and stop it tend to shy away. The debate then becomes, is it genocide or is it not, as we saw in the case of Darfur. The big debate ended with the United States saying, it's genocide, but we're not going to do anything different about it. And the UN saying, it's not genocide, but crimes are being committed that are not less heinous than genocide. That is why the issue of prevention at an early stage, before positions harden and people get into denial, becomes critically important. And for me also, if genocide is an extreme form of identity-related conflicts, then potentially it is global, which means that it can erupt anywhere in the world, even though some areas are more vulnerable than others. By the same token, not all countries where you have diversity and gross inequalities erupt into genocidal conflicts. Some manage well, and some are dismal failures. And so it's very important to carry out case studies that show how identity differences are being managed by different countries, to look at good models that can be emulated as success stories, and bad ones to be avoided. I often say that as terrible as apartheid South Africa was, they did avoid what could have been a catastrophic genocidal situation. And we were able in the end to find a solution that despite the differences and despite ongoing problems, all South Africans, irrespective of their color or race, or now believe themselves as citizens of South Africa on more or less equal footing. The whites, who had such overwhelming power, and the majority of blacks who were so angry, the conflict could easily have been genocidal, but they avoided that. Why? Was it the wisdom of the leadership? Was it the involvement of the international community? Was it something structural to South Africa? We want to know and see how we can build on that. I also think it is important to define the problem in a way that makes it possible to do something about it. If I'm so overwhelmed by the magnitude of the problem called genocide, then you are defeated before you try. And for me, optimism is a very important tool for action. And if you are pessimistic, pessimism is a path to a dead end. And so by reducing genocide, demystifying it into conflict of identities, which are based not just on differences, but on gross inequalities and abuse of people's rights, then we can deal with that, we can manage that. Then the solution becomes almost obvious. You have to work towards equality. You have to eliminate the gross disparities between people. And you have to raise consciousness around the world on this problem being not some up crisis there, but something that is part of how we run our systems, part of the governance system, part of our response to the human rights of peoples. And we are working on developing a framework of analysis with a number of, a set of eight categories which help us understand a given situation and what the prospects for a genocidal conflict are. These factors are cumulative and they tell us clearly. We develop them in partnership with many others who have indicators. We have shared them within the United Nations with other external partners and are now in the process of finalizing them, in fact have finalized them. It's a living document which from time to time we will analyze or we'll update. I believe that if states can look at themselves in the mirror using these criteria, they may be able to judge whether they are candidates for a genocidal confrontation or are performing well. And in that sense, this framework can be a tool for prevention. And so let me conclude then by saying that it is very important to try to understand the nature of the problem, and particularly to look at it in terms of how we avoid discrimination, marginalization, exclusion, and all of that. Also, early prevention before positions harden is critical. And my role as special advisor is that of a catalyst to be able to reach out, to alert, and to advocate, and to mobilize those who are in a position to do something about it, to act in a timely way. And there are many partners within the United Nations and beyond. I always say this is a mandate that is impossible, but must be made possible. And can only be made possible by my being purely a catalyst. And once again, I want to express my appreciation for the establishment of this center, particularly in this university. Those of my generation and those before us and those who followed us qualify to go to universities by passing the Cambridge School Certificate. And so the linkage is a very important one. And thank you so much for your kind attention. I've spoken much longer than I had intended, and I'll stop here now.